James Mann has done us the honor of joining us in conversation. Bill Russell?
There is a story that you tell that in some ways is, you know, is sort of definitive in this, about when Reagan was leaving office, how eager he was to get rid of the card. Right. That was, you know, his essentially nuclear destruction Armageddon card that allowed him to launch the missiles. And he kept trying to get rid of it.
That was the morning of the inauguration. Take it.
Give it to somebody. Which I think, to me, because everything's so personal with him, that's a very important...
He thought that his last day in the office was the 19th of January, 1989. And he was all set to, you know, finish his day on the 19th. And his advisors told him, no, the drill is you do have to work on the 20th. And he came in, he got the national security briefing, which actually came from Colin Powell, his national security advisor. And he reached into his pocket and pulled out the card with the nuclear codes that only a president has. Authorization codes, and he said, "Here, can I get rid of? And the advisor said, "No, no, you've got to keep that until just before noon when Bush Senior takes over."
There's another. I mean, it's not unrelated. I did not realize that we had given the Germans nuclear weapons. Having gone back and taken another look recently at the Soviet role in the Second War and what they endured from Germany and a lot of Eastern Europe and the history well before that, I found that in some ways Gorbachev's ability and willingness to move as far and as fast, yes, there were compelling reasons within the country, but his willingness and his ability, and in some ways his foresight and his courage, in the face of
what the Germans had done to the Russians
but also the intervening the post-war mm-hmm. period, mm-hmm. To me is a remarkable story. And as you make very clear, he couldn't have done it without Reagan.
Right.
That's amazing.
Gorbachev really, he needed political help from Reagan to proceed, certainly with his domestic reforms, because the whole and also with foreign policy. For his domestic reforms, he had sort of the old guard in the Soviet Union, which was always ready to say, we can't move domestically because we have this tremendous threat from the United States and from NATO, and so we got to maintain the security apparatus. We can't loosen controls. We got to maintain the military-industrial complex. And in order to win the argument with the old guard, he needed some help from Reagan in showing he was making progress towards a new relationship with the West. Now, it was a continuing argument. In the end, Gorbachev loses the argument. This is long after Reagan is gone in 91, and they move against him. But the point was, and the whole point with Reagan was, that it helped give Gorbachev really the time he needed to move to the point where the reforms were irreversible.
This goes to, to me, one of the really important things about this particular book is the demythologizing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, the de-stereotyping that mm-hmm. goes on, because everybody sort of revises history to suit their own perspective. And the relative roles, you say it was less that Reagan won
didn't win the Cold War. Gorbachev abandoned
it. Abandoned the field.
Well, to me, it's very the logic is actually very simple on Reagan's role. I mean, the argument that the traditional argument is Reagan built up America's defenses. He went ahead with the Strategic Defense Initiative. And that won the Cold War. Or he got up and gave this speech, tear down that wall, and won the Cold War. Or somehow that as a hawk, because that's how he campaigned, and that's a good part of his first term, that won the Cold War. Well, to me, that has the ring of truth and doesn't add up at all. And to me, it's very logical. When did the Cold War end? That's fairly easy. If you want... it doesn't matter whether you take a day or a year. It ended in 89, either with the Berlin Wall coming down or that whole year with all of the changes in Eastern Europe, in Poland, in Hungary, then everywhere. So that's when it. That's when, and why did it? Why was that the end? It was the end because the Soviet Union didn't intervene to stop this the way it had in Poland before, in Czechoslovakia,
Hungary.
In Hungary, yeah.
So, and then the question is, why didn't Gorbachev intervene? What was he thinking? And to me, you know, was Gorbachev thinking, oh my gosh, you know, there's a strategic defense initiative, so I better not intervene in East Germany? That no, he didn't intervene because he thought he had and wanted an entirely new relationship with the West, and that's really Reagan's second term, not his first.
The idea that you have to be able to deal, and Gorbachev was very impatient with Reagan, and Reagan tries to convert, in a religious sense, convert Gorbachev to being a theist of some water. The idea that individuals matter is not the same as the great man theory.
Right. Individual at the top, I mean, sure, history unfolds with much larger dynamics. There are much larger dynamics for the Soviet Union. The economy's in bad shape, but that the economy in bad shape, once again, doesn't mean that the Soviet Union's going to abandon Eastern Europe or abandon the Cold War.
Because that had been so important to them in keeping their economy up for such a long time.
Right. Individuals count, and they have their own idiosyncrasies. You mentioned the one which, you know, I can't identify with, which is Reagan was convinced that Gorbachev was a religious believer. And he goes into really his last summit in 1988. He's talked to his advisors about spending time in the summit talking to Gorbachev about religious freedom. Well, religious freedom is in the Soviet Union. That's, you know, that was one thing. But as you know, in our Constitution, there's a little difference between freedom of religion and establishment of religion. He takes this next step. He goes into a one-on-one meeting with Gorbachev. He's outside the presence of his top advisors, and he begins to talk about whether Gorbachev is a religious believer. And he does this. He starts telling a couple stories, as Reagan tended to do. He told Gorbachev he wished that his own son Ron, who is an atheist, were a religious believer, and so on. So, you know, you see an individual who happens to be president of the United States going off on his own. This was not, in my mind, the job of a president of the United States. Although I do point out in the book, this isn't a matter of Democrat or Republican. He wasn't the first, because Jimmy Carter had once done this with the leader of South Korea.
Over and over and over again, as I read both the rebellion of Ronald Reagan, which is an interesting concept, and the
closet revolutionary,
and then the ideas that carry forward through the Clinton administration that doesn't look a whole lot different from the Bush administration, that doesn't look, well, in some ways it looks quite different from Reagan after you tell this, it unfold the larger story. I kept fast-forwarding into all of this really matters when we get to looking how the military-industrial complex in the Soviet Union ruins the economy. In a moment when, fast-forwarding that 30 years, we're looking at many of these same things, it's like it's a yo-yo and then the string breaks.
Well, what I'm about to say now really is less in the book, The Rebellion of Ronald Reagan, than this previous book, Rise of the Vulcans. But you get, after the end of the Cold War, you get this period, very brief period, at the end of the 80s, the beginning of the 90s, when suddenly the Cold War is over, there is only one superpower. And the question is, and it's a preoccupying question in Washington, what do we need this huge military for?
The Cold War is over.
And you get debates in Washington about a peace dividend. What are we going to spend all this money on? And you get military leaders. There's a point at which Colin Powell, who is then military leader, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says, I'm beginning to run out of enemies. I think I'm down to Fidel Castro and Kim Il-sung. And there is a question of a large-scale cutback in the American military role. Well, in fact, what happens is that you get new rationales and new rationalizations for a large American military.
There's a great deal more to be said about this. Let me break in now so that I don't have to break in a moment. James Mann is with us. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, we trust you'll be with us when we return in a moment.